content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and Virtuoso Travel's Boundless Quarterly. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to enjoy some unique journeys, starting with a father-son backpacking trip in the Grand Canyon is an introduction. This article, written by John Briley, is a special to the Washington Post. The story also appeared in the April 11, 2021 Weekend Extra edition of the News and Observer. As intros to backpacking go, this might be pushing it. At noon on a brilliant Tuesday in March, my 12-year-old son Kai and I are a mile and a half into a four-day, 27-mile walk through the Grand Canyon, his first backpacking trip, when he asks, "Are we almost to camp?" No, camp at Hermit Creek is 7 miles and nearly 2,500 vertical feet below, a trek that will take us several more hours. We're descending the Hermit Trail, a poorly maintained path off the canyon's south rim, and have paused on a precipice across which we can see many of the canyon's neatly stacked layers, the chalky beiges and browns of the upper Kaibab, and the Tarawip and the Coquino formations which yield to the Yinkish pastels of the Hermit, Supai, and Redwall deposits below. This is on display in cliffs hundreds of feet tall, a stark reminder of how far we have to go, and how quickly we could get there with one misstep. We are here largely because of a birthday note Kai wrote me 2 years ago, in which he declared, "You used to be a wild 10-year-old like me, and now you're a wild 53-year-old. I love you so much and never want to leave you, but until then, we can do so many things together. I am practically squirming in my seat thinking about when I'm old enough for the Grand Canyon." Well, there are, I suppose, dads who could resist that, just as there are fathers who would plan an experience-appropriate trip for their sons. I am neither, so here we are. Never mind that. Aside from simply being 12, Kai has done almost nothing to physically prepare for this, or that I haven't backpacked in 13 years, or that my badly dated gear is far heavier than what most people carry these days. The exception are hiking boots, which we bought a week ago and broke in a stroll around our neighborhood the day before we flew out to here. Well, all of this might be fine in a place where car, cell reception, and emergency help were within reasonable reach. But in the Grand Canyon, the slightest mishap, sprained ankle, dehydration, gastrointestinal ailment, broken water filter, can become a code red emergency, and it might even prove fatal because help, if you can summon it at all, could take many hours to arrive. Although I spend my share of time adventuring and don't sincerely believe I'm leading Kai to his doom, I'm still far more anxious than I'd be if I were flying solo here. This wouldn't be the case had I secured a permit to camp solely along the Grand Canyon's heavily trafficked main corridor trails, which feature ranger stations, emergency phones, and at least occasional sources of potable water, even though those trails are daunting. Instead, we have 2 nights in what the National Park calls threshold campsites, with pit toilets, BYOTP, that's bring your own toilet paper, and no other amenities before a final night in the corridor. We're carrying all our food, mostly dehydrated meals, and we'll have to filter our drinking water, but at least we're camping near reliable streams. And while backpacking poses a low risk of coronavirus transmission, we have masks at the ready for anyone we meet on the trail, and we double-masked throughout our travel here. We head on past low, twisty juniper, and pinyon trees, and clumps of sagebrush, clinging to the severe terrain. Soon the view broadens to the north rim, and the stack grows deeper down to the shadowy 1.8 billion-year-old Vishnu, a panorama that leaves Kai spellbound. "This place is amazing," he says, before inquiring again about the time left before he can cast off his pack. He has never even put on a backpack before. I rented him this one en route in Flagstaff, Arizona, at the same store where I bought his oversized hiking pants. That, coupled with the sun shirt and brimmed hat he borrowed from my wife, lends him a likeness to Paddington Bear out on a grand adventure. Oddly, a century ago, we would have had an easier go of it. The Hermit Trail was once a supremely maintained path that guided groups traveling on muleback to and from a luxury camp at Hermit Creek. The trail and camp were built in 1911 by the Fred Harvey Company, the hospitality division of the Santa Fe Railway, as an alternative to the Bright Angel Trail, which was controlled as a concession by the businessman and eventual U.S. Senator Ralph Cameron. A set of steep, scree-strewn switchbacks ejects us onto the Tonto platform, a sloping shelf of sage-hued shale festooned with prickly pear and barrel cactus, black brush, and spindly yucca. From here, we will head a couple of miles downriver to Hermit Creek, then buttonhook upriver to camp one night each in Monument Creek and Indian Creek before hiking out the Bright Angel Trail on Friday. We arrive in Hermit, dusty, beat, and famished. "Where have you gone, Fred Harvey?" But with no injuries, blisters, or other serious concerns, we find a site among the half-dozen or so etched into a steep embankment above the creek, with ample space between us and the two other parties here, a solo guy and two women. Nightfall in the canyon, depending on your mood, can be magical or ominous. Darkness pours into every crevice, pressed by chilling air, and tiny sounds assume deep backstories. We navigate a narrow path to the creek, and lulled by the sounds of a waterfall, lie back on a boulder to take in the stars. Twice I suggest we turn in. "Not yet," Kai says. "This is too unbelievable." The Wednesday plan is to knock out the 3.5 easy miles to Monument Creek, drop our packs and hike a mile and 1,000 vertical feet down to the Colorado River. And we reach Monument by 1 p.m., well in time for the river hike. But as I'm unloading gear, I glance up to see that my boy has fallen asleep, standing up, while leaning against a sun-baked rock. I backslide into a pit of guilt and begin to worry deeply about our 11-mile day tomorrow. Later, we are chatting with a trio of 50-something hikers from Flagstaff when one of them interrupts herself. "Just so you know, there's a bighorn sheep walking across the cliff right behind you." "Indeed, there is. Muscular, agile, with those flamboyant, comma-shaped horns. Once it reaches the far side of camp, it lies down and stares back from where it came." Kai is rapt, prodding me to take more photos and reporting on the animal's every move as I make dinner. We also meet two solo campers at Monument Creek, a guy named George Van Meter, who posts videos of his backpacking trips on his YouTube channel, George Backpacking, and an Oregonian named Joe Sacker, who is nearing the end of a 50-day hike. "It gives you more time to stare at nature," she explains. Like most long-haul Grand Canyoneers, Zacher had cached food in sealed, labeled plastic bins to dissuade theft by wildlife or humans at strategic points along her route. She had also endured many bitter, snowy nights, and her melancholic tone suggests she's ready to go home. That night, the wind ramps up, and the rain peppers the tents in bursts. I sleep maybe 4 hours and awaken with fresh worries. Will it rain all day? Can we filter enough water for an 11-mile trudge? Of the two streams between camps, one is too silty to drink, and the other, at Horn Creek, is radioactive because of uranium deposits in the hills above. Drink here only if your only other option is death by thirst, our permit says. And is this the day Kai cracks and folds, I wonder? But when we march out of Monument Creek at 7:30 a.m., with cool mist billowing down from the rim, I'm optimistic. Kai sets a brisk pace as the trail lurches up from the wash, then levels for the long haul. For most of the next few hours, we feel like we are walking in place. The Tonto wends into a huge red-walled embayment, called the Inferno, and our view, while stirring, holds distressingly steady. At one point, Kai spots the Flagstaffers who had left camp 30 minutes ahead of us, on the other side of the drainage, well within shouting distance. "Hey, Dad, they're right there. We'll catch them soon." But when we round the next bend, it becomes clear just how far the trail goes before doubling back toward the river. Alas, they are at least an hour ahead. By noon, the clouds have vanished, the temperature has settled into the high 50s, and we have wrestled free of the inferno. At many points we can see and often hear the river, a vein of quenching green sluicing far below. Vantages into the inner gorge show clusters of sharp spires hewed from the dark Vishnu Rock. But it's still a long day. As we trundle along, Indian Garden rises in my imagination, an oasis pulsing with taco trucks and margarita bars, live music, and happy mules ready to shuttle our packs up to the south rim. Kai breaks my reverie. What are those ropes? I'm convinced he's hallucinating, but then I see them too, telephone lines looping from the rim toward the corridor trails. Even without taco trucks, Indian Garden is another dimension. Mule stables, squared-off campsites with picnic tables, shelters and wildlife-proof food boxes, water spigots and the ranger station, all tucked in a grove of green-leafed cottonwood trees. George and the Flagstaff crew are there, as are at least five other parties, and my second emotion after deep relief is one of overcrowding. Friday, we rise before dawn and are the first ones out of camp. For an hour, we have the Bright Angel Trail and its soaring scenery to ourselves. A third of the way into our 5-mile, 3,100 vertical foot ascent, George breezes past us. A dad on day four cannot compete with a budding YouTuber. Kai finds another gear, shadowing George and firing off questions as we rise through the layers, past descending mule trains and day hikers, over stretches of snow and ice, and finally onto the level ground of the south rim. In that birthday card, Kai had also written, "Even when you're 100, you will always be wild." Nice. If I'm lucky enough to make it there, it looks like I'll have company. Well, biking has become an increasingly popular way to get some exercise and to travel in remote countryside. Mark Morikow, a writer for the Bend, Oregon newspaper, The Bulletin, recently took time to learn why Central Oregon has become a new playground for mountain bikers. His story was reprinted in the April 11, 2021 weekend extra edition of the News and Observer. Dateline, Madras, Oregon. To the west, Mount Jefferson and the Three Sisters glowed a bright white against a clear blue sky. Just below us, winding down an otherwise unimpressive hill in the middle of the high desert, were five different trails, all filled with jumps, berms, concrete pavers, and wood features. A mountain biker could spend most of a day here climbing and then riding down a different trail packed with free ride flavor. Combine the efforts of visionary mountain bikers and forward-thinking land managers, and the result is the Madras East Hills Trails, the latest playground for mountain bikers in Central Oregon. Located just east of Madras near Juniper Hill Park, the trail system includes 14 miles of mountain biking trails and 6 miles of horseback riding trails. Led by the Madras chapter of the Central Oregon Trail Alliance, also known as COTA or COTA, trail work on Madras East Hills began in 2019 and has transformed the area into a true destination for cyclists coming from Bend, Redmond, and even Portland. "We've had a lot of folks come out," said Brennan Morrow, the Madras chapter representative for COTA. "They've gotten rave reviews. They're such awesome, unique trails, and they're so fun because they're designed in a way that you can just ride out there all day, sessioning and doing different stuff. It's been super popular because of the unique nature of the trails, having fortified berms, large jumping features, and wood features. Because the trails are on land owned by the city of Madras and private entities, wood and concrete features are allowed to be built in the system. That is not the case on most other trails in Central Oregon, which are mostly on federal land, including the Deschutes and Ococo National Forest and the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. A lot of our trails in COTA are on Forest Service and BLM land, which really limits the scope of what can be built, Morrow said. But as we move to land that cities or private entities own, we end up with the freedom to build a better system. The Forest Service just has different parameters on what can be built. We've had total support from the city of Madras. They've been hugely helpful in developing this. While many trails near Bend have free ride features, most of them must be built within the natural surroundings, such as rocks, logs, and trees. The plethora of man-made features at Madras East Hills makes it unique to Central Oregon. Madras is a pioneer in so many ways with this trail system, Marl said. It's already created a bunch of revenue for the town. It's put us on the map, On the weekends, the trailhead is packed out, and that's maybe 10% locals. People travel here to ride the trails. I made the hour-long drive from Bend to Madras on a windy Sunday and met up with friends Mark Johnson and Andrew Williams, also both from Bend. We started out on the West Side Trail, one of the longer trails in the system, which led us to the west side of the network through the treeless area, the wind ripping into our faces. Before long, we arrived at a ridgetop, then descended a series of concrete berms and jumps. The trail then led us back east across the flats to the east side of the system. There we pedaled up a challenging climb and arrived at the top of another ridge where multiple trail options were available. We sampled a few different trails, including the White Buffalo and Quarantine, both of which include a series of free ride features and lead back to the main trailhead via the Bridge to Nowhere Trail. This trail included a wood bridge, paver rollers, and a large tabletop jump. After one more lap, we were ready to head back, having ridden nearly 10 miles in just under 2 hours. Even though Madras East Hills is built with a downhill free-ride experience in mind, we still managed to climb nearly 1,000 feet during the ride. For some riders at Madras East Hills, the climbing is less of a chore, as the area is open to electric bikes. While e-bikes are prohibited on most National Forest and BLM land, they are allowed on the network near Madras. We want to be a space that everybody can come ride, Morrow said. E-bikes being a growing category, with some debate going on, what we did was we designed the trail with e-bikes in mind for both types of riders. It opens up opportunity for those who might have physical limitations but still want to experience mountain biking. Morrow said the plan is to eventually link the Madras East Hills system to trails in the Crooked River National Grassland to the east, including the Gray Butte area near Smith Rock and trails near Prineville and the Okoko Mountains. We want to build trails moving that direction over the next 5 to 10 years, Morrow said. We want to connect it to a greater trail system that really interlinks our awesome terrain and beautiful scenery. We have a team at COTA working on that through the Okoko Trails Group. While Madras East Hills is an ideal winter and spring option, when many trails near Bend remain snowy or muddy, Morrow said the trails near Madras remain rideable year-round. They stay pretty good throughout the summer, surprisingly, he said. Here in Madras, we have a clay-based soil, so during the summer months when things turn into a dust bowl in Bend, our trails are packed down pretty nice. There are some soft spots, but we've been fortifying those with rock armor. And by the way, if you're interested in this particular site, you can find it online at madrastrails.com, M-A-D-R-A-S, madrastrails.com, and it's in Oregon. Well, you may recall in some past episodes of Armchair Traveler, we've read about hikers and climbers who have successfully traversed what is known as teeners, and we're talking about mountain climbers. And these are mountains that usually range from 13,000 to 15,000 feet in altitude, or maybe even higher. I have a cousin who lives near Denver, and her husband has become a member of an elite group of climbers who have reached the tops of all of Colorado's 14ers. Writer Spencer McKee recently wrote a commentary titled 10 Reasons Not to Climb a 14er in Colorado. It first appeared in the Colorado Gazette and was reprinted in the April 11, 2021 weekend extra edition of the News and Observer. Let's see what he has to say. Climbing Colorado's 14ers seems to be all the rage these days, but it's actually not that great. Here are a few reasons why it's an awful idea to climb these mountains over 14,000 feet. Number one, the mountains are so tall, the height alone can kill you. Altitude sickness is basically the body's adverse reaction to elevation gain, and if severe enough, it can be deadly. Most sources indicate that symptoms like dizziness and nausea can become apparent at about 8,000 feet of elevation, getting more severe with vertical gain. With Colorado's 14ers climbing above 14,000 feet, it's easy to see how this can be a cause for concern. Be aware of the signs of altitude sickness and return to lower elevations immediately if they are felt. I will have to add real quick before I continue the article. My wife and I and daughters, we visited Evergreen, Colorado, which is at approximately an altitude of about 7,000 feet, and then went up 1,000 to Red Rock, which was nearby. That's the famous amphitheater in the rocks in the mountain outside of Denver. And at 8,000 feet, I was huffing and puffing after climbing those steps, so I agree with what the writer says here. The second tip here is the uphill never seems to stop. Agree with this one, too. Most 14er trails in Colorado tend to be an uphill and then all downhill. Your thighs must endure an unrelenting climb, and your tired knees get no break on the return trip. Number 3, dangerous animals are lurking. Many of Colorado's 14er trails are quite remote, making wildlife sightings common. That sounds fun until you remember all the bears, mountain lions, and rattlesnakes that might be lurking. Even animals thought to be docile, such as moose, elk, and mountain goats, can kill under the right circumstances. Plus, if an animal isn't trying to actively hurt you, there's still a chance that one can cause dangerous rock falls and deadly terrain. While exploring Colorado's natural spaces, do your best to enjoy the state's wildlife from a distance. Number 4, the trails aren't always easy to follow. While some 14er trails are quite apparent, others require trail-finding experience with errors carrying a potentially fatal consequence. Don't expect a trail up a mountain to be a walk in the park. Prepare to use landmarks and other mountain features to navigate terrain like your life depends on it. Always do thorough research on a trail prior to leaving the trailhead behind. Number 5, the weather won't help. Whether it's wind, rain, snow, or unrelenting sunshine, the weather often takes its toll on Colorado's mountain hikers. Above treeline, there's no cover, and on a long trail, retreat might not be a quick process. Sure, sunny days without wind exist above treeline, but the days in between are the ones that will catch you off guard. 14er climbers must be ready to encounter a range of weather conditions during a single climb, and they also must carry all that gear on their back on the off chance of a surprise. It gets heavy after thousands of steps. Number 6, the trails can get pretty crowded. Don't go hiking Colorado's 14ers if you're looking for solitude. Some of the busiest 14er trails can see more than 35,000 people in a year and more than 1,000 people on peak days. Among the most popular hikes in the state, the only 14er routes that don't see big crowds are the climbs that are either extremely long or extremely dangerous. Even then, it's rare to be the only person on the mountain if it's a half-decent day. Number 7, parking is also a pain. Along with the crowded trails, expect crowded and limited parking at trailheads. This can sometimes mean having to park far from the trailhead, potentially adding miles to a hike. Might also mean changing plans altogether. Plus, don't expect the drive to the trailhead to be easy. While some of Colorado's mountains are very accessible, others require travel on some of the state's most rugged roads. Number 8, expect an early wake-up call. If you're going to beat the weather, afternoon thunderstorms are common, and beat the crowds on the trail and at the parking lot, expect to wake up early. Trailhead parking lots can start to fill before 6 a.m., and some routes are so long that a 3 a.m. start may be necessary. If you're planning to drive to the trailhead in the morning, make sure your alarm clock goes off early and goes off loudly. Number 9, relaxation shouldn't be expected. While some head to nature to relax, expect a 14er hike to be all but that. A strenuous endeavor where a number of factors require trail goers to constantly be on their toes, hiking a 14er is not what most seek for their relaxing day in nature. And number 10, you risk forming an expensive new hobby. Climbing 14ers in Colorado can become addictive thanks to the sense of accomplishment it delivers and the beautiful views that come along the way. Hiking one 14er will likely mean hiking more, and after that, big mountains outside of the state. It gets expensive, and it gets time-consuming. Proceed with caution. Well, tackling challenging, often difficult, and sometimes dangerous pathways can be what draws some to explore those locales that are best described as wild and free. That's the title of our next article, written by Jody Robbins. We go up north, well into the wilds of northern Canada, to experience wildlife in the polar bear capital of the world. Her article appears in the 2021 summer and fall edition of Boundless, a travel industry publication produced by Virtuoso Traveler. Bobbing in the bracing waters of the Churchill River, I don't feel a lick of cold, only pure adrenaline. I've come to Churchill, Manitoba, known as the polar bear capital of the world, with high hopes of seeing these lumbering white giants, and quickly discovered that this special spot is also home to an abundance of other Arctic animals. Thousands of beluga whales visit the Churchill River estuary each summer, and while the purpose of my trip is to view polar bears, it seems only right to take advantage of another opportunity to experience more of Manitoba's natural environment. We float in the river and our guide submerges a hydrophone, a device that detects underwater sounds. Within minutes, we hear squealing and whistling. The sounds are frequent and, to my untrained ear, joyous, as though listening to an underwater celebration. As I swim lazy circles around our boat, my goggles reveal cloudy formations floating nearby, and then their air bubbles surround me. Too excited to swim, I simply hold on to the side of the boat and watch the ethereal shapes of these distinct white whales drift by. After snorkeling, we expect to dart back to town, but instead, our guide directs our boat toward Hudson Bay. When a white mound comes into focus, the reason becomes apparent. A polar bear and her cub are strolling the boulder-strewn beach. I haven't brought my camera, but this is a blessing in disguise. Not focusing on capturing the moment allows me to simply live it. I'm mesmerized by the mother, who's more massive than I expected. Her sheer bulk is offset by her furry white coat, excellent camouflage for winter's blanket of snow. After patrolling the shore, the bears decide it's time for a swim. The frisky cub clambers over a rock and belly flops into the bay, narrowly missing its mother, who's floating on her back, lifting her paws in the air as though waving to us. We're spellbound, watching what looks like a National Geographic documentary play out right in front of us. Well, Churchill's remote subarctic community, accessible only by plane or train, lies smack dab on the polar bear's migratory path to Arctic ice. Sightings are especially common along the coastline during the fall when hundreds of bears are on the move. Though polar bear sightings aren't uncommon in Churchill during the summer, most wildlife viewings take place on tundra buggy tours. A tundra buggy is a large all-terrain vehicle with wheels that are 5.5 feet high with protected viewing openings as high as 10 feet above ground. Snug inside the buggy, we carefully cruise across the rugged terrain in search of wildlife. Eyes roaming over the tundra, I spot ravens, tundra swans, and a family of Arctic foxes. I feel like a paparazzo searching out an elusive A-lister, but every celebrity has their favorite bolt hole. Our guide makes for Polar Bear Point, where he motions to a white rock not too far away. Ever so slowly, the rock rises to all fours. The bear sniffs the air and plods in our direction, curious to view us in our enclosure. Stepping onto the buggy's outdoor viewing platform to safely observe these predators in their natural environment is euphoric, raw, and free, and yet so natural. We've become part of something larger than ourselves. This transient moment leaves an impression that will stay with me long after I've left these wilds. And Jody Robbins, this is her first time being featured on Armchair Traveler, and she has a Twitter account at Jody_Robbins, that's J-O-D-Y hyphen with the underscore Robbins, and you can follow her on Twitter if you like. Does a good job. Well, that's it for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.